Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. American Theater Company's latest production is of the absurdist classic Waiting for Godot by Samuel Beckett, a play voted the most significant English language play of the 20th century in a British National Theater poll. The play involves two characters, Vladimir and Estragon, who call each other Dee Dee and Gogo, waiting patiently, somewhat impatiently, and endlessly by a solitary tree, and waiting in vain for the arrival of Godot. Others arrive and go, but not Godot. And audiences over the year have wondered mightily on who or what Godot might be. American Theater Company's production features Sterling McCann and Craig Walter in the principal roles, with Tim Hunter and Ted Doherty in the supporting roles. My guest today is director Lisa Wilson. American Theater Company presents Waiting for Godot. It opens tonight, runs tomorrow evening and with a Sunday matinee, and Thursday through Saturday next weekend at the American Theater Company Studios at 308 South Lansing in downtown's East Village. Lisa Wilson joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Lisa Wilson, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's good to see you, Rich.
It is good to see you, and you're doing a great play that needs to be done in the city every so often, and this is the time with American Theater Company presenting Waiting for Godot. Is this a play have you acted in? Have you directed before?
I've acted in it. I did it long ago and far away when I was in graduate school. I did a very, very different production of it. I did it when I
think of it as being an all-male cast, right?
Yes, it's supposed to be an all-male cast, and Samuel Beckett is known for his You Do It My Way or The Highway, but he's dead, so he can roll over in his grave if he doesn't like what I'm doing right now. He's been known. He sued people for doing his shows the way he didn't like it at one point in time. He's the playwright who sued Joanne Acolytis for putting women in part of a cast of one of his shows and for putting it in a subway. So he's a real interesting playwright. He liked to be an auteur and put all of his control on everything. But I did it when I was getting my MFA, so that was in like 1979. And we did two casts. One was all male and one was all female. And ours was done in commedia costumes and masks. And so it's nothing like what we're doing with this production at all.
Now, from what I've read about how you're doing this production, you're really going back to the roots of the production. Or is it?
It really isn't.
I think they talk about the desolate tree, the tree.
It says, okay, a country road. And there is a tree. So there's a tree and there's nothing else. But when Richard asked me to do this production,
Richard Ellis
is the both the designer and he's the company manager right now. And he kept saying, well, we've got to do Waiting for Godot. And I was going, Richard, that's really – and he's going, well, we really need to do it. It's an important play and we need to do it. And we're the company that needs to do this. And I said, number one, it's really important that you have a Gogo and a Dee Dee who have a relationship, because Sir Ian McKellen and Sir Patrick Stewart have just done it on Broadway, and you can flip on any YouTube channel you want to and see these men doing this performance between the two of them, and you just see this chemistry and this laughter and this marvelous, you know, back and forth and back and forth, and you're going, this is the kind of camaraderie that you have, not to imitate that, but you really have to have two actors who have that kind of relationship if you're going to do this play. And you have to have a reason to do the play, and it needs to be American. I said, for us to do this play, it's got to be an American version of this play. I don't want to do a pale imitation of something that's far, far away. There's got to be a reason. So I started thinking, why would I do this play? Why would Tulsa come see this play? And what's going on in the world that has to do with this play right now? And I'm kind of a big fan of The Walking Dead. This is one of my dirty little secrets. I won't tell anybody if you won't.
All right.
My husband and I did a binge watch of The Walking Dead this summer. And if you think about it, The Walking Dead and things like The Last Ship and things like iRobot and many other shows that are on television and in the movies and other places right now that think about what is happening, what's going to happen, the fear of the crash on Wall Street, the fear of what's going to happen if banking falls apart, the fear of what happens when we're at the end and nobody comes to rescue us.
Yeah, it's just this sort of dystopian sort of...
This dystopian, what's going to happen? Well,
yeah.
That's what Godot takes place at, that time and place.
When was Godot written?
1930s? 1948.
Okay, so right after World War II.
Immediately following World War II.
Yeah, and everything was supposed to be great, but if you're living in England, you're still having rationing. Nothing's back to normal.
And he's just lived through World War II, and he's in France. And France is in total disarray. And he's writing for the Absurdist Theater, and he wants to be seen. This is Samuel Beckett, and he really wants to fit into the Absurdist Theater. So he writes it in French to begin with because he really wants to make a big splash in the Absurdist Theater. But then he translates it into English. So it is his play in English. And the two characters, Gogol and Didi, are waiting for Godot, this person, to send them word as to what they're supposed to do next. And all we know is that Godot is supposed to send word or meet them there. Godot has promised he's going to meet them there by the tree. This is all we know, all they know. And so they've been waiting. We don't know how long they've been waiting. They don't seem to know how long exactly they've been waiting. And they're down to a black radish, the last carrot, a turnip in the pocket, and not being sure, and they're waiting. And they are a couple, really. They're people who've been together for 50 years, they seem to think. So they're very uncertain. So in looking at this play and thinking about this play, no, we didn't decide to set it down in 1948 in Britain or in France or in post-war that. We set it down in it's then, it's now, it's the future. It's not a specific time. So some of the clothing is slightly reminiscent of maybe it's pulled from somebody's, whatever they pulled it from, these clothes from some things. They've got the bowler hats because there's a bit with the bowler hats where the hats get passed around that are semi-vaudevillian bit because people are amusing themselves. What do you do while you wait? You find things to amuse yourself. You sing songs, you make jokes, you argue, you do those things to make time pass. But you've got clothes that are pulled from the 40s when Pozzo, who is a landowner with his servant who used to be entertaining but now has basically lost his mind and is on a leash, a rope that goes around with him. Lucky shows up. He forces him to perform, shows up to pass the time. He passes the time. He dances. He thinks for them. And so you have these people who show up, and they're wearing clothes that look kind of like they're from the 70s.
Okay.
And then when the boy shows up, he's wearing something that is very much now. And that's intentional because I want the people to think about this isn't just then. It's not something far away. It's now, it's then, it's us. And we break the fourth wall with this. And I've done very intentional American dialects that are very recognizable because I don't want it to be far away. I want it to be here. I want it to be very recognizable. I want these voices to be voices we know and we recognize. We know. We go, I had that argument.
Right.
I know that argument. I've had that quarrel.
And that's when you read through the script, I mean, there's a big part of this thing. Well, what are we doing here? You know, why are we here? Why are we here? We're waiting.
Okay, well, yeah. Well, what do you think we did? Well, where do you think we were yesterday? Well, if you think you know so much, then what did you think happened? You tell me exactly then.
Right, right. And again, it's this situation of the unknown. Mm-hmm. And I like the idea of having this different clothing to say, okay, it was then, it is now, it may be tomorrow.
Right. And as I said, it's recognizable and yet it's not. And when they start worrying about what they're thinking and the thoughts that start haunting them, and isn't that what happens to us at times? We are haunted by our thoughts. We're haunted by our past that we can't shut out. And that's part of what they do. Gogo, who is a little bit simpler as one of the characters, wants to sleep. He wants to escape into sleep. And his companion, Didi, is afraid of being alone. And he's very afraid every time Gogo goes to sleep that maybe Gogo's died. And he keeps waking him up because he doesn't want to be alone. He's very afraid of being alone.
Well, let me ask you, you mentioned that Samuel Beckett was very particular about how this play is staged. Is there a copious amount of stage direction and sort of,
there are some,
you're
going
to do my show sort of thing?
Yeah, there are some specifics, and we follow most of the specifics in terms of, you know, he gives specifics about there's a silence here, there's a silence there, the crack of the whip that Pazzo uses, that he uses a whip to make Lucky do certain things. He has him on a rope. So we follow those directions, and we haven't set it on the top of the Empire State Building or anything like that.
Right.
We didn't move it in that way. But my Pazzo sounds a lot like a Southern plantation owner, and it fits the speech perfectly.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Because he is of an upper class.
Mm-hmm.
And for Americans, when you hear that, you automatically go, oh, that's that gentility that I think I'm better than you are sound. No, I can look down on you because I had something that
I can
you
speak
didn't
up
have.
And look
I
down
can,
at you at the
I
same time.
I can speak up and look down at you and be kind and look down at you at the same time.
Well, you talked about having an important relationship between the two principals mm-hmm. of this. And it sounds like you have two really amazing actors that we see all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Sterling McCann and Craig Walter. What do they bring to these two parts?
Well, to begin with, they have worked together before, and they bring a wealth of experience, but they bring such generosity, and I give them a framework to start from, and then this is a play where you don't work it the same way as you do other plays. I mean, you do a little bit of background, but because it takes place in this miasma of their minds where everything's not certain. The moment before that something happens is so short, is what they feel like they're certain about. You don't sit down and go, what did you have for breakfast? And what did your mother think? And what did, you know, start with all of that. And they play off of each other. So it is a question of their being very sensitive to each other and them being willing to play. So it's urging them to play and them being willing to take all these chances off of each other. And they do. And that's what's so delightful about these men is they really listen to each other and they have such great camaraderie. And there's a bit in the play where there's three bowler hats. One of the hats gets knocked off of Lucky and it gets left behind. And Dee Dee goes, oh, look, he left the hat. And he picks it up. And he says he's going to try it on. So he hands his former hat that's been bothering him to Go-Go. And then Go-Go shifts and puts his hat on. So as we start a cycle of the hat shifting between the two heads, three hats, two heads. And they start shifting around. And the way they play with this, you give them a framework that's in the script, but we've altered that.
And you just let it go.
And you let it go. And you have a contest within the play of them having an insult contest that's written, but the way that they do it has to do with these two actors. And you kind of give them little boosts and suggestions, but you just kind of give them small suggestions towards things. I mean,
and I would assume with them knowing each other so well that they're trying out lots of things in the rehearsal.
Yes,
and your role
we
is
shape it.
Your
we
role
shape
is
it
say,
bit.
Okay, well, that worked. That not
yeah.
so much.
What do you think? What do you think about this? Yeah, well, try something else. Sometimes it's try something else. You know, you get to be a little bit of a Spielberg. That's fun. You know, I was watching a thing about Tom Hanks and Spielberg, and he goes, try something else. So sometimes they get to do that. And boy, is that a joy. That is a joy.
I would assume all these actors really are looking forward to doing this piece because you don't do it that often, and it's sort of this classic that it's a very different type of acting. Because you don't have that all that background, and you don't have necessarily that destination.
Yet you have
and the resolution
moment. You have in the moment, and you try. They're trying so. The characters are existing in the moment to get to the next moment. And Dee Dee is a character who is very hopeful and living for that hope. And when he discovers for that moment that hope is dashed, you're dashed with him, and you watch him pick himself back up and hold himself together for the sake of his partner. Because when his partner's really dashed, and that's what we do for our partners sometimes, is we go, we can't both be dashed at the same time, because then we really will fail. Yeah. So, I mean, you laugh with them, but you also go, yeah, that's what we do. We pick ourselves up and we put one foot in front of the other and we go on.
My guest today is Lisa Wilson, who is directing American Theater Company's production of Waiting for Godot by Samuel Beckett. It opens tonight. It runs tomorrow with a Sunday matinee at the ATC Studios on Lansing, and continues Thursday through Saturday next week at 8 p.m. evening performances, and the Sunday matinee at 2 p.m. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you talked about Sterling McCann and Craig and their rapport. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the rest of the cast.
Pazzo is played by Tim Hunter, and Timothy Hunter is a wonderful actor, and I have really asked him to do something very different in playing
Pazzo. Southern plantation.
And I keep telling him, well, it's a little bit Blanche DuBois with a little bit of an evil bit of The Devil Wears Prada. So, bring in a little Catherine Venable to it from, you know. Yeah. So he almost flirts with them, and he's like a big cat in that he sort of, you know, he comes in and he toys with them, and he has this very, so he's a landowner, and I have him playing this Southern landowner with him, and he's very feminine in some ways in the way that he's playing this.
It sounds like it's a Southern belle.
He is in some ways that he's playing this. He's mm-hmm. very, it's just lovely because he gets to play all of these wonderful colors of his, so he's so involved with himself and what's happening to him. You know, and that's who Pazzo is. Pazzo's very involved with himself, and that's the choice we made, was to do it that way rather than having him be this really big, harsh character, because sometimes he's played as this very overly loud, harsh character. We went in another direction because we're in this little studio, tiny 99-seat, space this playing space is not quite as big as the studio we're in right now, so it's very intimate. So we had to find a way to play it within that. And Lucky is played by Ted Doherty, and I say that speech is one of the most difficult speeches, I think, probably.
Tell us about this speech.
In theater. This speech, well, the speech is Lucky thinks for them. So Lucky is playing a character called a Canuck, and a Canuck is supposed to have been he's kind of like a jester or a character who was an entertainer that was kept by the upper class.
Does he speak truth, though?
He speaks.
Like the jester does?
He used to speak truth.
Okay.
But if you look at this, he is, you take the actual through line of it, it is talking about the existence of a god who is substantiated by a bunch of of outside sources that are questionable.
Okay.
So it is a speech that begins to fracture and decompose as it goes along. So the speech itself, which is about 5 minutes long, becomes more and more and more and more fractured. So I liken the speech and Lucky, because he's kind of at the end of his lifetime. End of his rope. Yes, exactly. End of his lifetime. Pazzo's on the way to the fair to sell Lucky, because he is not functioning real well anymore, to a steampunk cuckoo clock that's lost it.
Okay.
And he begins his speech fine, and he, given the existence of a personal god outside time, without existence, qua, 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 qua.
And he begins unraveling.
And it
gets
worse. And
so that makes it really tough.
Which is a very difficult speech. And then you watch him unravel and unravel and unravel and unravel until finally nobody can listen to it. They attack him. They knock him down on the stage, and they remove his hat so that he'll stop talking, because he can't think if he doesn't have his hat on.
It sounds like a crazy speech. And I guess Ted is doing a good job with this?
Oh, yeah. He's doing a marvelous job with it. But it is one of those speeches that everybody in the world would love to have a try at.
Right. You're talking about Tim Hunter's role earlier, about Pozzo.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume he would have these expectations of how he's going to play Pozzo, and you came in with this very, very different vision.
Mm-hmm.
How do you negotiate that? I mean, you are the director. He said, do it.
I suggested this to him when we did the beginning of the auditions, and he tried it out, and he says, I'm from New York. And I said, just give it a try. I think you can do this, because we'd worked together in another production I was acting with him on. I said, I think you can do this. I said, because I think the thing is that this is a matter of control, because the ability to use language to control someone is what Pozzo does. You carry a whip, so you can use that. But it's the fact that you've got little claws that you can spring at people, and that you don't have to raise your voice a whole lot. And that it is that Miranda Priestly kind of thing, but it is that very Southern type of control that you have and disapproval type of thing, where you turn and you go, you mentioned Godot. You took me for Godot. Who is Godot?
Yeah, right.
You know, so it's very much more controlled, and in a small space that's much more effective than a big booming voice.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting thing for him to play with, and it works. He does it so marvelously. It's a hoot. It is a real hoot, and it's really fun to – I've giggled through the whole thing.
Yeah.
And you got to please the director, make her giggle.
It's good.
It's good. It's fun.
Well, let me ask you, going back to that original idea of why do Waiting for Godot, you said, you know, I'm looking around, I'm seeing all this dystopian television and film, and really we are in this sort of, and it probably does point to uncertainty about the future. How does this play speak to that, in addition to all the other pieces that are out there now?
What it speaks to is that at the heart of survival is relationship. At the heart of survival, what we have, the thing that will take us forward is relationship. The thing that will take us forward is the person that we love, whoever that person is, and the fact that we're there for each other and that we choose to be there for each other, and we find a way through because of the other person, and that we play whatever the game is that we have to play to make it through to that next moment, and that we have hope because of that other person. That's what it is.
And really, when you think of that whole genre, the ones that are successful do have that sort of relationship at their heart.
Well, that's what it's about. Absurdist theater is about people. It strips away everything else. That's why there's very little on the stage. There's a tree, and there's people. And there's not, you know, big dancing cats or, you know, lots of things
that
flying.
That might have been a very different play.
No. And there's not lots of things flying, and there's not, you know, any helicopters coming in and out or anything like that. There's not things that are taking you away from that. Instead, an absurdist play says you have to be there with the people and the words. And in this day and age in particular, where you have so many machines and you have so much distraction, to be there with the people and the words and the relationship is reminding you of exactly what is at the heart of what winds up getting you through.
All right. Well, we hope a lot of people come out to see Waiting for Godot.
And on Halloween night, we have a special. If you wear your bowler hat or a semblance of a costume, half price Halloween night.
All right. Waiting for Godot tonight, tomorrow, and Sunday in the afternoon at 2 o'clock, and then Thursday through Saturday at the American Theater Company Studios. Lisa Wilson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
Lisa Wilson is director for American Theater Company's production of Waiting for Godot by Samuel Beckett, which opens tonight with performances tonight and tomorrow at 8 o'clock, with Sunday matinee at 2, and performances next week, Thursday through Saturday, at the American Theater Company Studios at 308 South Lansing in downtown's East Village. Visit myticketoffice.com for ticket information. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Today on Studio Tulsa, we welcome a new commentator. Jeff Nix joins us.
Humpty Dumpty famously said, "When I use a word, I use it to mean what I want it to mean, no more, no less." I've been a lawyer for a lot of years, so I learned, like most lawyers do, that it's important to use the right word for the right situation. And, as in the world of law, most people in the modern-day world tend to give common words a literal meaning. We like for words to have a kind of a universal meaning, a dictionary definition. Unlike Humpty Dumpty, we like to have words mean what they're supposed to mean. Yet everywhere we look and everywhere we listen, there are signs and sayings that, if taken literally, make no sense whatsoever. Example, you drive by a house with a sign in the yard, "For sale by owner." Who the heck else would be selling it? A neighbor? On the outskirts of towns, you see a sign on the highway, "We'll build house on your land." Well, I would sure hope it's going to be on my land if I'm paying for it. We see signs in business parks saying, "We'll build to suit tenant." Geez, I'd hope so. Tenant wants to sell cars off a huge paved lot. Owner builds a 25,000-square-foot building. Not going to work at all. Speaking of signs used in business, how about ads that say, "At these prices, they won't last"? Well, I got news for you. The reason I'm even thinking about buying another one is the one I have didn't last. I want to buy one that will last. Or have ads that say, "X dollars while supplies last." I always wonder, after supplies are gone, what'll the price be? Does it go up or does it go down? You see a sign that says, "Price to sell," as opposed to saying, "What? I've got these things priced so high nobody will buy them and I can keep them all." We see and hear ads that say, "Tell your doctor about other medications you're taking." Shouldn't your doctor already know the medications you're taking? And if you didn't get them from your doctor, where the heck did you get them? And we see and hear, "Ask your doctor if such and such medicine is right for you." Whoa, what a great idea! I was going to ask my piano tuner if this medicine's right for me, but asking a doctor sounds so much more professional. Or take the modern-day world of politics. Of course, Humpty Dumpty would have been a huge hit in the world of political campaigning, where the word is said, then supposedly explained further by a spin doctor to have a totally different definition, all with a straight face. We sometimes hear those in government or wanting to be in government say, "I want to provide transparency in government." Since when is it a positive thing to have government so lacking in substance that you can see right through it, like air or water, or, given we're talking about the world of politics, gas? Like I said, the world of words of advertising and politics clash mightily with the legal and dictionary definition world. Like when I hear a candidate's negative ad about an opponent say, "My opponent lacks convictions," I can't help but think, "Lacks convictions. Must have had a good lawyer."
Jeff Nix is a new commentator here on Studio Tulsa. He's a native Tulsan, a former trial attorney, a part-time musician, and concert promoter. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own, do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.